To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Leo Phillips here with This Must Be The Gig, your little backstage pass to the world of live music. Every single week we bring you fascinating conversations from the beating heart of the performance scene with some of the most exciting names on this big, gigantic, spongy globe. We talk passion, we talk first concerts, insights into the creative mind during this truly unusual time, and everything in the juicy center.
This week, we're excited to share a conversation with Olafur Arnolds.
It kind of bothers me when people take my music too seriously.
Like a fusion of classical composition, modernists like Avril Part, and his own background in punk, Olafur's compositions tap into an immense well of emotion and deliver surreal heights. His latest album, Some Kind of Peace, appropriately paces his face directly on the cover, eyes closed as if in the middle of a dream. That powerfully personal and intimate feeling swims throughout the record. In this chat, Lior spoke with Olafur about his old hardcore band, Fighting Shit, his introduction to composing through German metal band Heaven Shall Burn, what makes his new album his most personal, touring with Sigur Rós, and so much more. So let us not be delayed. This is Lior and Olafur Arnolds. Enjoy!
When you emphasize freedom and individual freedom for so long and so heavily, people eventually will lose the sense of community. You know, that people, I don't know, I'm an outsider. I'm looking at it from the outside. But it does seem to me that the sense of community and the idea of that we are actually human beings that should be helping each other and caring about each other seems to have made way for just extreme individualism.
Being in the music industry, I've never really made the connection, but I wonder if we are a little bit more prepared because we're constantly in situations where we have to take into account our fellow man, especially with you as a touring musician. You arrive in a city you might not have been before, and then you meet this team of new people who, you know, if you don't have your crew with you, your full crew, and you have to kind of be, you know, respectful of their machines and their equipment, respectful of a new crowd.
Yeah.
And the same with, like, if you're going to see a show, obviously there's etiquette, which sometimes is not exercised as it should be, but you kind of get a bit prepared in that way. And I'm not saying that the entertainment industry, because I feel like that's the first industry to have imploded, you know, from everything this year. But I feel like there is a sense that most people don't really know how to behave in public spaces or with their fellow man. So I feel like, I don't know, you know how it goes when you're traveling, and you have to be so careful, and especially as an artist, you have to take care of your health as well.
We've had our fair share of cultural sensitivity training.
Exactly.
By touring all over the world, you arrive in a new culture and you instantly have to just like look around and see like, how do things work here?
Right.
How can I fit in? How can I respect these people? Because also, like, as a musician, you're kind of a public person, and if you do something wrong, people are gonna hear about it, you know.
Exactly, and they're gonna talk about it. They're gonna comment on it. You are that.
They're gonna tweet about it.
Yeah, how dangerous to think that people's fingers are the most dangerous weapon in the world right now. But it is true. So when you do go to a new city, do you feel like you have to immerse yourself in the culture?
I guess it depends on a little bit about. On how long I've been on tour. Usually when I start out, or if I do one-off shows, if I go to a faraway country for one show, I really like to immerse myself in that culture, really take time a couple of days beforehand and really get to know the people before I play for them. I love walking around the city and just getting some sense of the energy and the culture before I actually stand on stage in front of these people. But if you're playing a new city every day for, let's say, 40 days in a row, you're just not able to immerse yourself in every single culture. So then I tend to withdraw and become very introverted, and I just be 100% focused on the show at hand. I spend all my days just helping the crew out and just kind of spending my time on the show rather than taking a walk in the city. Because it just tends to become too much for me. My brain doesn't handle, like, as soon as your brain realizes, like, oh, you've been in a new city every day for 40 days, then it goes a little bit crazy. But you can kind of ignore that by just, you know, immersing yourself in the show, because the show is always kind of, there's the same equipment on stage every day. There's the same setup on stage every day. So it can be like a home. Traveling home, so I like to just spend all my days on stage just working on my set.
That makes sense. Also, it's like a good coping mechanism emotionally, because if you do suddenly stop and realize how many places you've been and how that physicality is so draining as well, and how overwhelming that all is, I suppose that would take away from what you're actually there for, which is, you know, the performance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It can do. And you just get so confused. Like I have definitely had my like Spinal Tap moment where, you know, with Hello Cleveland and they're not in Cleveland. Has actually happened to me.
Where did that happen? Where were you?
I think it was in Lisbon, and I may have said Barcelona, which is, they're kind of rivals. Yeah. It's like Portugal and Spain. They're rivals in football. It happened in Edinburgh, and I said Glasgow. That's worse. That's definitely worse, because they hate each other.
What did you say? How did you recover from that one? Like, how did you recover from saying that? Did you just carry on playing?
Oh, no. And now I remember. This did happen in Lisbon or Barcelona, but I remember now what happened in Edinburgh. I didn't realize how close the cities were. And they're just like an hour away. And we weren't playing Glasgow on that run, but we were playing Edinburgh.
Okay.
And being in Edinburgh, I went on stage, and I like to joke around on stage quite a bit. And I said something like, you know, we're only playing Edinburgh on this run, so it's really great. Like, and I don't know, but I said something bad about Glasgow, just as a joke to kind of make the Edinburgh crowd laugh.
Yes.
Turns out half of the crowd was from Glasgow, and I was booed. I was actually booed.
Oh my God, this is like a horror story. Like, you're a stand-up comic and bombing on your joke. Yeah. Shit.
But I love it. I loved it. It was a great moment. It wasn't mean booze. It was laughing booze, you know.
Because you are a certain type of artist and you make a certain type of music. I know that isn't your history in you know, your career, but I think maybe people expect you to come on stage and be quite serious, or expect you to come on stage and be a certain, maybe not speak, which I think is also a wonderful thing. Sometimes I don't even mind if the artist just goes straight to their, you know, their instrument and starts. But if you, if you have banter and you are engaging with the crowd, I think that that's such a wonderful way to also show that this style of music isn't, it isn't necessarily, I don't want to use the word serious, but it isn't necessarily inhuman. You know, it's very human and it's still made by a human. It doesn't need to like be this some eclectic mystery from, you know, from Iceland. So I think that that's kind of great that you do that.
That's precisely my thought behind the whole thing. It kind of bothers me when people take my music too seriously, because it is quite introverted and melancholic and sure, but I'm a social person. I like to joke around, and that part of my personality I really want to show through the music somehow. And being on stage, actually just being me and not being like pretentious about everything being super serious, I think gives people a much better understanding of what the music really means, like what the real intentions are behind the music, that it's actually quite positive most of the time. And besides, I just like to break people's expectations anyway. That's just I just like to nudge things, you know, like, oh, you think it's this way? Actually, it's going to be that way.
But I love that, because also doing that, especially in a live setting, and I know that it's difficult to do when, especially now, I mean, coincidentally, we're speaking on the day that your record has just been released. So congratulations on that.
Yes.
Your new album, Some Kind of Peace. And I also feel like some people, they don't, when they want to get into that kind of internal headspace and that melancholic, they want to escape, and they feel that they can't feel a multitude of emotions, because it might be hard to tap into that. You know, people feel it's like being completely submerged. Sometimes your music can do that, you know, and I think that some people just feel very overwhelmed by maybe doing that. So in a live setting, you may not have the guts to sit and bawl your eyes out or dance, exactly. You know. So I think it's almost kinder in that setting where it's like a sound bath almost, you know. And so,
it's just like how movies, like sad movies, need one comic relief moment,
right?
You always need that, if only to give the sadness context. Like if you don't have the dynamic range, I don't think the feelings are really real that are being delivered there. Like if I'm going to play a sad show, just as an example, I don't believe it's sad, but like if I want to make people cry the whole show, I can't start by playing a sad song and just play sad songs through the set, because there's no dynamic movement in that. You have to start from somewhere more positive and then bring people with you to that place and then bring them back up at the end of the show, because you don't want to be mean.
Yeah, you don't want to torture anybody.
No, you don't want to send them home crying.
I mean, I don't mind a good cry, so I don't mind that. But like, for example, I saw Sigur Rós at a show somewhere, and then I went to cover them at another show, and I was in Australia at a festival. And the person, I was taking photographs in the pit, and the person in the front row was literally holding on to me because she couldn't contain herself. She was so, and to be honest, some of their music is really quite light and fun. It's like cheeky, and you know, if you and again, you don't need a certain ear to listen to it. It is all about subjectivity, of course. That's music, but she was holding on so much and slobbering all over me and crying. And I was just like, I was so overwhelmed because I felt so terrible. I wasn't crying. I was blown away. And like my feet were sinking into the ground because it was so, you know, it was such a beautiful performance. But it just shows you how everybody can have that interpretation of that music, whether it is considered classical or ambient or instrumental.
Exactly. And I think it's a matter of association as well. Maybe that person that you're describing went through like a really difficult time and that music helped her or him get through it. And hearing it again in this context, in a live context, which can be very overwhelming. Every feeling gets so magnified when you're playing live. And it can just bring them back to that whatever they were going through. And therefore they're crying, even if the music is positive and happy. but I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah.
That's really beautiful. And like I've thought about this like an insane amount because it like basically for the last 6 months, like every person in my position, I really miss playing live. And then I start thinking like, why do I miss playing live? And it's there's a few things. There's like, of course, live shows are an opportunity to explore the music in very different ways and it gives you a new creative input. And then there's the energy of having people in the room and just, you know, I think that's the main thing about playing live. It's a communal experience, which is just different from listening to music alone. When you hear something with other people, you feel their energy. You see that girl next to you holding you that's going through something, you know, and you feel the energy of the musician on stage. You feel the acoustics of the room. That part we cannot replace. I just don't see any way we can replace that. But there's another element to playing live, which is the storytelling aspect. And for me, playing live has always been this opportunity for me to really tell the story of the music. Like we were talking about before with the anecdotes and the jokes on stage. Sometimes I tell literal stories of the songs, what they're about or what inspired them. Sometimes I just make a joke, whatever it is. It's showing people who you are and they are understanding who you are and then understanding much more about the music. They're understanding the music in a much deeper way by sharing this space with you in that moment. And I think this part we can do. We can do that somehow.
Yes.
Now. I'm still figuring it out, but I don't think we can like get the energy to live streams, but we can get a community and we can get storytelling through social media, music videos, live streaming, you know, maybe just making a short film about the album.
Right.
And these things are what I really want to explore for the next months when there's definitely no touring.
I mean, and I know this is also the most personal album that you feel you have released. So the idea of not touring it right now, I suppose, can be at once kind of relieving, but also quite sad that you aren't sharing that with the world in that way.
In some sense, I think this is my album that needs touring the least, because I think there's much more storytelling in the music itself than I've done previously. It doesn't need as much explaining as for example, like my last album, which was this like more elaborate conceptual idea. This one is just more, hey, this is me. And by listening through the album, you should just get it, I think. So I don't think I need the touring as much. but at the same time, I really wish I could stand on stage and talk about these songs, talk about what I was going through when I made them. But we have been working really hard on other things that will come out in the next few months where we are doing exactly that, like doing storytelling of the album. And I think we've just been too busy working on solutions to mope about not being able to do what we originally wanted to do.
It's true, like your brain has to click into that solution-based problem solving. Mm. Of this horrible riddle that we never know if people will even join in on a live stream or if that community will be there or as receptive at a certain time and time zone. So I also loved your quote about how the album ties to reacting to life. I feel like that's so opposite from the idea many have of composing or of ordering in a structured kind of world. So how is that sense of control almost adjusted for you as a composer, that you won't have that on a realistic level now, but also just within your music and how people interpret it?
For me, this whole period has been about acceptance. It's about just accepting what you cannot change. As cheesy as that sounds, we are all different levels of control freaks. Mm-hmm. And I think so much of our anxieties and consequently, like, not being able to create, not being able to do what you really want to be doing and follow your dreams comes from this anxiety, from not being in control and always having this need to control your situation. And that's why we feel sad when something happens to us, because it's something that we didn't control. We didn't choose that to happen. And I just kind of feel that way about this whole pandemic. And there was a moment a few weeks in where I just kind of curled up into a ball and I started crying,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I didn't understand. I was like, why is this so sad for me? I live in Iceland. I can, you know, there's
you
like,
there's
not happening so much here.
Yeah.
I should be so grateful, you know, but I just felt like the weight of the world on my shoulders, and something was happening to my like fellow human beings that I cannot help with. I cannot help anyone. And I cannot control this. I cannot stop this. And I was grieving like my tiny little like rituals, like, oh, I can't actually go to that cafe in every morning now and read the newspaper and have my Americano because it's closed. And these tiny little things, they just start just weighing so hard on you when they, and there was just this moment where I just had this full on release from all of that. And there was just a full acceptance that this is no different than anything else in our lives. We actually don't control anything. And this pandemic is just showing us that and reminding us of that in a very extreme way. And as soon as this clicked, then I could go back into my studio and I could write so much music.
Wow.
I could do all these things. I was so clear from these thoughts. I don't know if that makes sense.
It absolutely makes sense. I feel like we all grieved in some sort of way, and whether that was like a continuous grieving.
It's also an opportunity to change our ways, I think, like with touring stopping. Right now is an opportunity to look at how we do touring, why we do a touring, and if we can do it differently. Touring is pretty bad for the environment, to be perfectly honest.
It's awful because it's never the thing that bands want to really address. And then when bands do address it, they are labeled as environmentalists or hippies. So it's a very contentious, but it's certainly, if you're in America, for example, you can get away with getting in the car. If you've got the resources, obviously not every musician does, and has a driver that you can drive around. But if you're touring, say, Asia or even some places in Europe, it's just quicker to take a half an hour or an hour flight. It's more productive.
Yeah, I mean, I live on an island. I don't go anywhere without getting on a flight.
Exactly. Right, exactly.
Pause the podcast! It's time to step away from the conversation with Olafur Arnolds ever so briefly to share a special segment. We typically like to share our live stream or live show of the week, but this week we wanted to continue putting a spotlight where it's most needed and instead highlight an organization we think you should contribute to. This week we're highlighting the National Independent Venue Association and the Save Our Stages Act, which aims to preserve and nurture the ecosystem of independent live music venues and promoters throughout the U.S., and to ensure that independent venues nationwide can keep from closing permanently due to the pandemic. To learn more, contribute to the Emergency Relief Fund, and find links to contact Congress and support, head to SaveOurStages.com. That's SaveOurStages.com. But for now, back to Lior and Olafur. Enjoy!
And it's not only the flights, there's so many other things. Like even just the tour buses, getting people to the concert is one of the worse things for the environment. If you, especially big concerts, like 20,000 people arriving in cars, you know, those are have huge environmental costs. There's the plastic waste backstage because local promoters really like to make things simple, so they use plastic stuff. Even in the auditoriums, they use plastic stuff. In my case, we've been really trying to change this, just, you know, kind of just behind the scenes, like working with promoters to like do things differently. And it's really hard. It's always just like, well, this is how we do things.
Yeah,
we've always done it like this. And I'm not kind of big enough or important enough to make them change their ways that they've done for years and years. So if we just stop for a couple of years, which seems to be what's happening right now, maybe now is then the opportunity to restart in a different way. Maybe now is when we can actually change these things.
I mean, small promoters, I understand they have so much working against them, irrespective of this year. So prior to this year, mm-hmm. but huge festivals who really try and make a green footprint and really try those places. I mean, even like, I'm just thinking back to when I covered like Roskilde back in, God, it was like 2004. Like maybe 7 years ago or something, they already were, it was Rockvechte in Belgium. That's a huge, I think that's like over 100,000 people. They already were trying.
Yes, I played there.
Yeah, that's an insane festival. I don't think I will go back for a while, but I'm a little bit shocked, but you know, but it was amazing. I remember.
Can you imagine my music there? Oh my God. That was pretty fun.
In one of the tents, I can imagine
it was actually great.
You almost have to, again, it's one of those situations where, like, you know, everyone is high and you know, like tripping their balls off, and then you've got to kind of get everyone into a zen moment to experience it. But that's it's like a meditation almost. You need to get people and usually obviously your music is better suited to a beautiful sound stage where, you know, everything is illuminated. And like, have you ever played Le Guess Who before? The one in Utrecht?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Something
played
like
that
Tivoli, that Friedenberg location where it's like.
Yeah, I played the Tivoli like three times.
I feel like I might have probably seen you there. That's like one of my favorite venues because anywhere
it's
you
a
sit.
Beautiful venue.
It's not even so.
Yeah, 360.
Everything. The sound is. Yeah. God, it's so crystal clear. You can't even hear people talking. I don't even think people do speak at that festival anyway. Like, very respectful. But, you know, like at Rockvechte, I remember walking and being stopped by this long snake train of cups. It was plastic cups, and the whole initiative was if you collect plastic beer cups and return them, if you collect like 20, then you get a token to get a beer or something. So it was it was not only like, let's say, obviously it wasn't like, let's save plastic because they were still using it at that time. But it was like, let's try clean up at least. So there was a mindfulness there. And if, you know, that's a bare minimum that you can do. You know, obviously you've got to incentivize humans because they won't do anything unless they win something. But there's so many ways that you could do it. I almost wish like musicians would form some sort of coalition, but there's so much happening with Spotify. You have so much working against you as an independent artist already that it's so difficult to, as you said, no one wants to change their ways so quickly. So it's up to you then. You've got to then get into, you know, get into a pattern of not getting into a car every day or getting on a plane all the time. Or if you're on a plane, then you've got to be away from home since living in Iceland. Then you have to be away from home for a long time. So the logistics are really kind of messy.
The logistics are messy. Speaking of a coalition, I have had conversations with a bunch of artist friends.
Yes.
I think this idea originally came from me and John Hopkins. We were talking about like, what can we
amazing.
Do? And we started about forming a coalition, like a tours, like to do our tours together, share the equipment trucks, share the tour buses, try to form some sort of a team, maybe 3-4 artists, that would not even necessarily playing the same venue. You can have totally different crowds that still play the same city each night, but you could still share like a lot of the logistics to half the environmental costs of your tour. And also financially, it can could make sense. But then something came up and there was no shows anymore. So that hasn't happened yet.
Well, but, I think that that's a first
But I think
step.
It would be beautiful to see. Beautiful to see artists kind of get together and think about solutions together. Another thing we really noticed last year, or yeah, on my last tour, at one time I started counting the plastic bottles my crew was drinking of water every day. And I have 20 people in my crew, and let's say each person, because like the standard is plastic bottles backstage for the whole crew. Because like you don't know where you are in the world, maybe the water from the tap is not that great.
Filtered.
So
yeah.
It's just like a standard. You need filtered water, and the standard is, let's say, 20 people times 3 bottles each. So you have maybe a crew of 20, which is not even the biggest crew that you'll find. Like major artists have 100 people in their crew, and each person drinks 3 bottles of water per day. On my tour, that was 60 plastic bottles every single day, and we were maybe touring for 150 days. Can you count those bottles? You know,
no, it's
so
a
just a very simple thing. Like, we bought a bunch of reusable bottles. We marked them really, printed some nice logo on them for the crew, so it would be really personal, so they wouldn't lose them. And we give everyone reusable bottles, and then just asked for like water stations around the venue to just refill them, and boom, you know, 60 bottles a day saved by a very simple gesture. And all artists can do this. You don't have to do it publicly. It's all about just changing these tiny little ways. You just change the way you phrase your artist writer, for example. Just change some wordings in the artist writing, and that will, you know, in your contract and stuff, so there will be less plastic. Just put in your contract no plastic cutlery. You know, there's these tiny little things. You have to do it once, and then it's the same document that goes out to everyone anyway. It's, you can do these little things by just being conscious and making your crew conscious of it. And then by doing that, you're also teaching the promoters. You're telling the promoters, oh, this is something that the artists want. So then slowly the promoters will also change their way. And once they change their way, that's also the audience-facing part gets changed as well.
That's so true. I hope it does shift a little.
It's like dominoes.
Yeah, I hope it shifts a little bit. And I think that conversation that you were having prior to coronavirus hitting and the pandemic taking over the world, I think that that's kind of the thing. Those are the exciting things that are going to come out of this, hopefully. But so when you first obviously started getting into the music scene there, do you remember the very first show you ever saw when you were younger?
Oof. I started going to shows pretty young, like 14. I started going to punk shows, and I think possibly the first one was with American band Sick of It All.
Okay.
American punk band from,
wow.
You remember them? They played here.
Did they? When was that?
They played this would have been 99.
Oh,
probably.
Wow.
I'm 13, maybe it's in 2000, I'm not fully sure. Some dudes from the punk scene kind of helped getting them to Iceland.
Amazing.
To play a show. It was crazy, and I just fell totally in love with punk and the attitudes and the ideologies. And, you know, within a year I was vegetarian and like fighting against animal testing and like
it
hit me hard. The punk hit me hard, and I'm really grateful, actually,
because I understand that you drummed for, like, you know, hardcore and metal as a teenager, so, and you had your own band and everything, which we'll get to. But so had you, prior to that show, had you been playing an instrument or doing anything, or was that the catalyst to get you into it?
No, I had been playing since I was 5. I started music school when I was 5.
Oh my God. Little prodigy.
So first with piano.
Wow.
I don't know if I was any good back then, but there was certainly...
Let's just say you were.
Yeah. First with piano, and then I actually really didn't like piano that much. So when I was like 6 or 7, I asked my parents to change to drums. So I started learning drums instead of piano. And I didn't really come back to the piano until I was like 16 or something. Drums are just way more fun for a little kid.
It's true.
It's
really true. And also because you have no conception that you don't understand that coordination is actually so difficult when you get older. There's that primal aspect of drumming that really...
If I play drums now, it's not that anymore because I haven't touched drums for like almost 10 years now.
Oh my gosh.
In any serious way. And I used to be quite decent drummer. I won an award
you
here
did?
For drumming.
Oh my gosh.
Battle of the Bands. my band didn't win, but I got a special award for my deep beat skills.
Yeah.
but nowadays, if I touch the drums, not only am I bad at it, but because I used to be good at it, I'm now bad at it and aware of that I'm bad at it, which is the worst.
Got the hindsight.
You're like trying to play and all you're thinking is like, oh no, this sucks. Oh, this is horrible. But when you're a kid and you're just learning, you don't know that. You think you're great all the time.
Yeah.
So I'm very discouraged whenever I try playing drums these days.
Well, actually, speaking of shit, it wasn't the band. The band was called Fighting Shit. That was the band.
That was one of my bands, yeah. Yeah. That was the best band.
Absolutely.
That was in a few others.
I love hardcore band names from that age because the names that teenagers think about, it's so brilliant.
It was totally serious. Yeah. Like we were fighting some shit in this world, you know? We had to fight the shit.
Yeah. No, dude, I'm on board. I've already made t-shirts. Yeah. I've got a mug. I'm on board. what was the best name that you can remember from that scene around that time? Like just around you, who was playing? Was there some, I don't know, do you remember some of the other bands?
The best names I can think of were in Icelandic, so they won't make sense here. Yeah, all the best names were in Icelandic, actually.
That's so funny. How come you guys named yours? Was it just because you were so influenced to what it was what you were listening to at the time that you chose to have it in English?
Like, I think honestly, it was actually a joke at first. Someone just said it and we were like, okay, that's the name of the band.
Yeah.
We didn't think we were going to do anything with this band. We were just like a super thrashy, like our first couple of songs were just complete jokes. And then we kept going and we got better and we got more popular within the scene and we started touring. And like at one point we were like, should we change our name to something serious and actually good? And it was just kind of too late.
You've done it to yourself.
Yeah, I still think about it. Like, oh man, that name. I wish we had changed it. Because it was actually a good band. I'm very proud of what that band did. But yeah, so my career as a composer and a solo artist is directly related to my past as a punk hardcore drummer. We were supporting this band on a few shows. Like, so Fighting Shit opened up for them. So I got to know them and I had been doing some demos of like more piano-based music. But at that point, it was all like MIDI computer sounds. It was not good. I didn't have any real recording equipment or anything. But I gave this demo to one of the guys in the band. And they emailed me a few months later just asking, can you write some like intro and outro for our album? And they gave me a small budget to record with the real strings. And then they go on to have a top 10 album in Europe and in Germany. And so suddenly I had this recognition without having made any plans for that. And I wasn't even planning on doing an album, but a record label called me up and said, do you want to do an album? We'll release it. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'll try.
I'll give that a go.
But it was never, I thought I was going to become like just a drummer for the rest of my life. And then this just kind of happened.
But so I feel like some people consider metal music and classical to be on the opposite ends of the spectrum, but there are some real connections in terms of composing with that extreme emotionality and that like wide dynamic range. Do you see the two as interconnected in a sense?
Yeah, I do. I mean, to me, it's all just... kind of destructionalism idea of this, just like it's just music. It's not. It doesn't have to be metal or classical, because those are ideas that we created. It's in the end, if you ask objectively, if you ask the universe, what is this? It's just going to be sound frequencies. So I think there isn't as much difference as we like to tell ourselves. And yeah, they're both types of music that can become a little bit complex. I think they have a certain complexity in common in terms of like the counterpoint and kind of internal structure of the, you know, of everything happening within those music. Like if you listen to metal music, it's often very progressive and complicated time signatures, and same with classical music. It's very progressive a lot of the time. So you'll find a lot of metal fans are really into classical music as well. That's very common.
To be able to be a metal drummer or like a jazz drummer, those are the hardest. I'm talking about like, you know, completely improvisational jazz, but it's those are the hardest things to master because, as you said, it is so progressive, and there is so much in terms of the pacing and the timing, there is so much to take into consideration. It's almost like it's like a maths equation. And I love that classical music can turn into that as well.
I think it's also both are very emotional. Like punk music is pure emotional expression. And then what I'm doing today is just a very subtle version of that. It's just expressing big emotions, but just trying to use restraint while expressing those and letting the kind of sparseness and fragility and all the silences in between the notes deliver those feelings. But they're both very kind of big emotional expressions.
So was there a band that you toured with, or, because I know early on in your solo career, you toured with Sigur Rós and you've had a lot of different, you've been around a lot of different bands, and obviously in Iceland, I know that the camaraderie and collaboration is just, you know, look at your work with genre experimenting with Chiasmos, and I don't know, there's so much of that collaborative spirit. So was there a band that you toured with that taught you a lot about maybe not only touring, but also your own music? And
yeah, absolutely. So my first tour ever, funnily enough, was with American post-punk band Cursive.
Oh my god! I supported them. That's crazy.
Like my whole beginnings were still really much tied to the punk scene. Yeah, and all my connections were in the punk scene. My agent was like a booking agent that was really focused on post-punk, post-rock music. So they gave me my first kind of opportunity to go in front of a slightly larger audience, like a few hundred people every night. But then I think my big change in touring, big break kind of came with touring with Sigur Rós. It wasn't a very long tour I did with them. It was just a few shows. I had already done a lot of touring at that point. I'd played hundreds of shows on my own all around Europe, and I was always kind of playing for 200, 300 people. And I was just kind of stuck there. And then I did this tour with Sigur Rós, and it just opened me up to a whole new audience. And I think more importantly, seeing them on stage, this was on their tour around the album Með suði eyrum við spilum endalaust, that 2008 album, which was a very positive album. It was very happy and upbeat and uplifting. And just seeing them have so much fun on stage. And they invited me on stage to, I always played the last song
Amazing.
With them, like some extra drums. On. And just seeing all the fun they were having really changed my approach to my whole thing. And I remember saying out loud to, I don't remember, my tour manager or something, like, I don't want to make sad music forever. I want to make something happy, because if I'm doing this every night, I want to be happy. You know, I want to be enjoying myself. If I'm playing shows every night, I don't want to be so serious all the time. I want to be light and uplifting and have fun with my crowd. And it really changed and took away that seriousness that I had had previously. And I think by bringing that aspect into my live shows and into my music, that also just opened new ways for me, that I kind of found it, you know, so to speak. I found that the thing, that it thing, that hook, or that it was missing till that point.
Is there a show that you've seen live, a performer that really has stuck with you? You know, because I think all of us, I think the music you make and the music you listen to doesn't necessarily have to align, but was there a live performance that you saw that just blew your mind? Like maybe when it was on tour or...
Seeing Radiohead, finally, like I've been a fan since I was a child,
yes.
You know, and I only saw them for the first time 3 years ago. That was possibly my favorite live experience ever. They played in Iceland and it was just wonderful. I don't know if that live show particularly inspired me, but I was just such a fan.
Yeah. You
know? I was just happy. I was just that person who was, it's just all coming together and I've gone through so much with their music that I was just happy.
Yeah.
I was just so happy. They played forever too. They played for like 3 hours.
Oh my God.
And I'm a person who hates long shows. I grew up in a punk scene where 20 minutes is too long, you know?
Yeah, get in, get out.
When Fighting Shit toured, we would like, we made a word for ourselves by having the shortest shows. I think the record was 9 minutes.
No.
It was in Leeds in England or something. And we played for 9 minutes. But there were still like 11 songs we played. Yeah, and just like played them really fast. We just kind of liked to blow people out and leave.
Yeah.
But so I kind of grew up with not having much tolerance for very long shows, but Radiohead played for 3 hours and I still wanted more by the end. So that was, I think that's the definition of a good show for me.
The amount of things that you've worked on, it's so wonderful that you've worked on so many different things. Like, I wanted to ask you about that ballet that you scored as well. And that, I mean, like you've also, your music has been used in soundtracks and things like that. But I think, you know, taking that love of music and then scoring or being a part of somebody else's vision and project, it is a gear shift. You know, you have to prep yourself for putting your emotions aside and telling someone else's story. So how has that been for you to work on a ballet or have your music used for soundtracks? How has that been for you?
Yeah, it's as you say. Well, I've scored also a lot of films and TV shows and stuff like that. And ballet, it's been so long. Actually, when I did that ballet with Wayne McGregor, it's called Die at 1909, and it was about Shackleton's expedition to the South Pole, which happened in 1909. That was very free. I didn't have to think too much about the story. I would just write some music that I thought fit kind of the general subject, and then we just kind of melded it together in rehearsals, and we changed things and kind of he adjusted a lot of the dance to fit the music rather than the opposite. But when working on films, I think it's different. Then you're really, because there you have like specific scenes,
right,
that you have to tell a very specific emotion that the scene is missing or that the scene needs, or you have to support something that's happening, and then you're really dwelling into or diving into someone else's story, absolutely. And I love doing that. It's really fun. You get a set of parameters or limitations that you have to work within, kind of. No one gives you those. It's just like that is the project. It is within these limitations. This is the story you're working with. And by having all these limitations, it kind of forces you to be even more creative to find solutions. Like, I think it's when you have all the freedom in the world, you have too many choices, like, and things can become a little bit lost. Whereas if you limit yourselves and you give yourself certain values or parameters to work within, you can really get hyper focused on solutions to that, musical solutions to that. So that's the fun part of it. Nowadays, I'm like you'll see on my new album. Like it's a very personal one, and I think I'm much more interested in telling my own story these days.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I think that that's also it's you know, you've done so much work in almost, if you look at it, kind of a short amount of time. You've released a lot of material, but I think also with this album, you have some wonderful collaborators as well that fit so well into your range. Like you've got JFDR, who's, I just think she's wonderful. And
yeah, she's amazing.
What was the most rewarding collaboration? Maybe one that you hadn't thought of that kind of was a bit of a surprise?
That's probably Josen, who is featured on the song The Bottom Line.
Yes.
And we wrote that song together. She came to Iceland to work on a couple of songs with me, but it was actually more for her solo work. Like I was gonna co-write or produce some stuff for her album, and it kind of just went the opposite direction. Yeah. And
working on yours. I mean, that's a smart switcheroo. Yeah. You know? Well done.
We did a bit of both in the end. Like we have songs for her as well. But yeah, there was never the plan for her to be so, have such a big feature on my album at all. But when we started working together, we became so close so fast. We became really good friends. We had an absolutely wonderful time together. We got into really deep conversation. And I told her a story one night over a drink. And we were, you know, she was so interested in it. It was about something that had happened in my life, a big transformational moment for me that happened last year. And then we split, and she went to our hotel, and we met back up in the studio the morning after. And she brings full-on finished lyrics.
Oh my God.
And says like, hey, I was so touched by what you told me last night, I wrote the lyric about it. So she comes to the studio with lyrics that are actually written about my experience. Wow. That I was sharing with her. And that was so touching, this kind of selflessness in the writing process. And I can't write words. I'm very bad at writing words and lyrics. So I've worked with singers, but I always have to work with singers who write the lyrics, and it's often hard for me to connect with those lyrics because they're not mine.
I didn't write them. But in
this case, I can connect intensely with these words. So that song became like my first song that features vocals and lyrics that is actually still super personal to me. Now, actually, when I think back to it, maybe this was her sneaky plan all the time, because I remember she was always asking a lot of questions when I was telling her that story. She kept going like, and how did that make you feel? You know, it was always like she was taking mental notes, like already planning to go home and write this lyric. I should actually ask her.
Look, if you've got an overall long-con plan, I'm in, you know. It's a cheeky way of sneaking in, but I'm in.
Yeah.
When you say that something is personal, it's often misconstrued into I am releasing it, that I've never done this before. It's such a heavy moment, you know, when you say something is personal, but it doesn't have to be heavy. It can also just be a release, you know, just really putting yourself out there. So is that how, I mean, I can't even imagine, we obviously speaking on the day that it's all out there in the public, but what have you done to kind of prepare yourself for having people experience it in this way?
Yeah, I don't know the answer. I'm still on a, you know, it's just coming out and it's just happening right now. And, you know, my phone is going crazy right now. And like, sure. I'm still like processing the whole thing. I've still to check social media quite a lot. Like I haven't been reading really what people are saying about it, but yeah, there are definitely like moments in there that are very vulnerable, because I sampled some things that are actually from my own life. You put some field recordings where you can hear conversations in the background that are actually just from my life. So it is quite vulnerable to kind of put that on an album and release it to the world like that. But I haven't done much to prepare.
Also,
for that.
I've distracted you just, for the last
just waiting
hour,
for the,
so yeah. There's no way you can have prepared because I've been taking hogging your time.
But yeah, I'm really excited to see what people think, and also maybe it's just in my mind that it's obvious. Maybe it's not that obvious, and people won't sense it as the vulnerable thing that I think it is. You know, I don't know. Or maybe they will suddenly know everything about my life.
Tell me everything. But also your face is on the front cover, which obviously you've been on your covers before. But the last few ones, if I'm just looking at like the different album covers, mm-hmm. the last few ones you haven't been on. So I think there's kind of some artistic metaphor in that, you know, you are front and center. So I'm assuming people will take
this. Felt like the right album to do that with. Yeah. I never want to do that unless there's like an artistic reason for that.
Exactly.
I don't want to put my face on the cover just for promotional reasons.
Right.
And I'm not that pretty anyway, so it probably won't work.
Dude, you look like this ethereal ghost-like this being that doesn't exist in the human world. So I promise, it looks good. It looks great.
I kind of look like I'm dead, don't I?
A little. I mean, I suppose you look a little dead. This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble. We'd like to thank Dean Berger and Daniel Brater for additional music, as well as the Consequence Podcast Network. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod. And generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.